KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. It's been estimated that 1 in 10 couples in the U.S. struggle with infertility, but more treatment options are becoming available. In the popular TV series John and Kate Plus 8, a couple suffering from infertility used artificial insemination to have children. What they didn't plan on was the set of twins that arrived after the first treatment, and after the second treatment, a set of sextuplets. Well, fertility research is now showing that the risk of accidental multiple births is dramatically decreasing. Maybe you're someone who's struggled with infertility. Have you used in vitro fertilization or artificial insemination? Were you happy with your decision? Give me a call at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. Maybe you're considering in vitro or egg freezing, but you're still a little bit skeptical. Call 800-289-5869 or write to conversation@KUOW.org. And with us to answer our questions, Dr. Paul Zaretsky, Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Washington. He helped found the National Coalition for Assisted Reproductive Technologies. That's 206-543-5869. Thank you for coming, and we appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, Russ. Thanks for having us.
Is it about equal between men and women? Is about the same percentage of men afflicted with infertility as women?
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the misconceptions, because women will come to their gynecologist and say, I can't have a baby. And we forget there's the guy, which is about half of the issue.
Why do women get the rap?
That's a good question. It's because I think they come in for more health care related to the fact that they're the one trying to have a baby.
And when you look at, let's look at men first of all. What are kind of the top reasons why men might be infertile?
First thing we think of is disease processes. Infectious diseases, venereal diseases can cause problems. The second big area is toxin exposures and environmental exposures and issues related to their work environment and things that could have happened there. Then down the list a little more are trauma, things related to accidents as a young boy, a bike accident, soccer injuries, things like that. And then there's a group of what are called congenital, or you're born with it, type problems, where the vas, the connecting tube between the testis and the outlying tube, is gone.
How about just age? Do men age out of fertility?
Men do age. The good news from men is we produce a lot of sperm, unlike a woman that makes one egg per month. So those variation numbers, even though they're going down, don't really show on the boards in terms of outcome data until you get into your 70s or 80s.
How about the energy of those sperm and their viability? Does that decrease with age?
It does. And the age-old story, it takes only one sperm to fertilize an egg, is true. But unfortunately, that sperm has to be in the egg. Mm-hmm. The further away you get from the egg, the more sperm you need. So functionality of the sperm is a key issue in natural intercourse trials. We bypass a lot of that in our technologies because we are putting the sperm closer to the egg.
And what are some of the primary reasons why women might be infertile?
Well, the main issues we see are ovulation problems where they're not making eggs correctly. And that can be seen as issues related to the menses or the period where it's not regular in the process. So that's a really number one area that we look at. Tied to that oftentimes are different disease processes, diabetes, obesity, hypertension, diseases that may alter the kind of production that the woman has in that process. The other important area is the structure of the woman, the ability of the cervix to function, the uterus, and the fallopian tubes. And infection is a major issue there that can compromise the functionality of the implant site.
Dr. Zaretsky, are there categories of infertility in both men and women that you can't do anything about?
That's a great question because, you know, if you asked me that 20 years ago, there was a lot. And the reason for that was because we didn't know. So when we didn't have the opportunity to see what happens when sperm and eggs get together, the in vitro fertilization technology, is we had to guess. So if a man had a certain number of sperm, we said, gee, that was pretty good. And if a woman had a period, that was good. But with the advanced technologies where we can monitor follicle growth with ultrasounds, we can assess men's functionality of sperm. But more importantly, through in vitro technologies, we can actually put the sperm and eggs together. So it's been estimated in the past when I was a student many, many years ago that a third of infertility was considered unknown reasons. Now we're down to less than 10%.
Is infertility something that is at all inherited? Can someone, if your father or mother is infertile, is that something that might be passed on to you?
Through disease processes. So you could have a disease
process. So it's indirect.
Yes.
It's not just that. We're talking today about infertility and what's being done about it. And we're at 206-543-5869. Dr. Paul Zaretsky is with us again to answer your questions on this issue. Are there any preemptive strikes, so to speak? Can someone get vaccinations or treatments at a young age to prevent infertility if they think that might be an issue in their future?
Not vaccines, but you raise a really important point, is there are things you can do. Infection is a really big issue here, is to prevent venereal disease transmission, a really important area to keep that risk factor down. Second thing is to regulate your ovulation. If you're having early problems and you're a young girl and you say, gee, my periods aren't regular, real important to see the doctor right away to figure out what's going on, because intervention then may avoid some problems down the line. For men, it's really trauma and infection issues as well, is if something does happen, don't ignore it. If you get hurt in a sports injury playing soccer, don't assume it's okay. I mean, see somebody and get evaluated.
Are there any tests people can take if they want to conceive children, but they just want to kind of, before they go into that process, find out whether there might be some issues there?
Yes, we call it kind of the first step. If you're there by yourself and you're on the internet saying, gee, I want to have a baby, what will pop up on the internet is assessing your ovulation. So you can buy a home ovulation kit, fairly inexpensive, and at a given time in the month, you can start testing for this. And what that test is doing is it's measuring the brain hormone that is used to stimulate the egg growth. It's called luteinizing hormone, and that measures that and says, wow, you know, that's happening. So that's a really good first step in the process.
How about the dudes?
Well, sperm analysis, you know, there's not really a good over-the-counter test to say, do you have sperm? There's some tests you can buy to measure the prostate production of chemicals, but you got to go to a lab to count the sperm.
If you just joined us, we're talking about fertility and infertility with Dr. Paul Zarudsky, 206-543-5869. You know, you mentioned a lot of people assume that it's usually the woman's problem. Not true. It turns out that men have just as many issues when it comes to fertility. Has that translated to the kind of research that's done in preventing fertility, in preventing infertility? Is there as much research going into dealing with the men's side of it as the women's side?
There was, and if I look at the history of this, it was very exciting in the 80s and 90s because those questions were being asked, particularly as you mentioned earlier about infertility of unknown reasons. The more we began to investigate sperm function, and at the University of Washington, a lot of work was done in that area, and Dr. Moeller was looking at that in particular, asking, you know, what happens to a sperm and why does it fertilize and what happens in that process? And the good news, bad news is patients would come to us and say, well, thank you so much for telling me my sperm don't work, but I'm going to have a baby. And so, yeah, and so what we began to do was say, well, let's put the sperm and eggs together. So when in vitro technologies began to grow in the 90s, and then a specialized process called intracytoplasmic sperm injection, or ICSI, I-C-S-I.
Okay, unpack that for us.
Yes. What ICSI is you're literally injecting the sperm into the egg. Hmm. So what ends up happening now is we're bypassing so many of the issues related to sperm functionality by simply putting the sperm material into the egg directly.
Let's go to Kristen, who's listening to us today in Redmond. Maybe you've got a question or comment about issues having to do with infertility. Kristen, good afternoon. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Well, my husband and I tried to conceive for about 2 to 3 years without intervention, and we were unsuccessful. And so our first step was to go to an OBGYN, actually a nurse practitioner, who, you know, ran a couple tests. We did Clomid. We did IUI, intrauterine insemination. And then we were referred to a fertility clinic. And it seemed that the focus once we were there was not on trying to figure out what was wrong, but more on trying to get us pregnant. And that was really off-putting to us.
Huh. Interesting. Would that happen when you went to a clinic? What do you have to say about that, Dr.
Yes, Zarudsky? I kind of talked about that, Kristen, a little bit. That's kind of what happened in the science, is that there is a frustration factor, and you're very, you know, you'd be exciting to a practice like us because you want to know what's happening. But so many people, you know, when they look at the expense of that and the time of that, they're going to look at an option and say, if I have to spend thousands of dollars to find out that my sperm's not working, maybe I should just do in vitro. And so I think, unfortunately, you're absolutely right, is that that's kind of pervading. We have to be really careful in counseling patients to ask that question of, you know, if you're interested in that, there are tests that we can do to answer that. I just want to ask you one question. Is the one point I didn't bring up is age. So I'm not going to ask you your age on the radio, but for the audience, it's really critical when asking that question of, you know, am I 30? Am I 40? What are my chances of getting pregnant? It goes down significantly as you approach 40. And the old adage, well, just try for a year and see what happens, was true in the past, but that's okay for a woman who's 30 years old who has a pretty high pregnancy chance. But as you hit 40, you really should get investigated much sooner than that.
Hey, Kristen, did you have a follow-up question?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to know if, you know, if someone is interested in finding out, you know, rather than, you know, we did test after test and everyone was sort of puzzled about why I wasn't able to get pregnant. And we ultimately ended, there was a happy ending. We ended up adopting, and it was wonderful. But you know, I was really interested in finding out why the heck I couldn't get pregnant. And is there, I mean, and the problem is that my health insurance refused to pay for that. Is it just sort of, you know, an unanswered question for women and men, or is there another avenue that we can take?
Yeah, are there a lot of people who never find out?
Yes, and your points are good about the insurance issue. That's a really critical issue. What I do, Kristen, and patients like you, is I tell them, think through the workup you had and break the categories into what I call form and function. And so when I'm talking about ovulation, the form of that, you know, are you ovulating, you're looking at periods, you're having LH surges. But the problem, short of doing in vitro, where you actually put the sperm and egg in a dish, is the functionality of the egg you don't know. Just because you're having a period and making an egg doesn't mean that's a, quote, good egg. It could be a dead egg. It could be an immature egg. So those are the thing and frustrations that a practitioner says when a patient says, well, I want to know. Well, I can't tell you the kind of egg you're making. I can tell you you're releasing an egg, but the functionality is an issue. Same thing in the reproductive system, that if I do an X-ray or an ultrasound and say to you, wow, the uterus looks normal, the tubes look normal, that's a form description. That's not a function description. It doesn't say those tiny little hair cells that move the egg down the tube are working. We have no test for that. And same thing with the sperm, that because the numbers look good doesn't mean they can actually fertilize an egg.
Kristen, I'm glad it worked out for you well that you adopted a child, but did you ever find out the answer to your question about why it wasn't working for you and your husband?
I never did. And, you know, ultimately it didn't matter. But I, you know, at the time it was certainly very frustrating, and I wish I had had your guest as a doctor.
Thanks for sharing your story, Kristen. Let's go to Peter. He's listening to us today in the Wedgwood neighborhood. Peter, good afternoon. What's your question?
Oh, hi. Yeah, my wife and I were trying to get pregnant for years and years. It wasn't working out. And went to in vitro at the doctor. And finally, we had a pregnancy that sadly failed. And the doctor said, it was after analyzing the fetus, it was some problem called non-Robertsonian translocation, which is really supposedly a rare chromosomal issue. And my question is, what's the likelihood that this is passed down to my son, who was subsequently born afterwards, just by, just sheer luck?
Dr. Zaretsky?
I would actually like to answer that in more general ways, because I don't know the exact numbers for that disease process. But the question's a really good general one is, when you make an embryo in the dish and it looks good, again, the idea of form and function needs to play in the mind of the practitioner and the patient. All embryos that make blastocysts that have a potential to implant can do one of three things. They can make a normal baby, they can make an abnormal baby or a translocation defect like yours, or they can make an implant that fails and a miscarriage. And the driving force for that is age of the woman. That really dictates where the distribution is in that. And the advances of genetics today are really exciting in opening that field up.
It sounds like you're not familiar with the issue that Peter had. How can he find out the answer to that question about what he had? What it could it get passed on?
Yeah, the genetics group at the university are very good at that, and probably he could get some information on that from the genetics medical genetics group. And if he wanted to give us a buzz, we'd be happy to get him that information.
Great. And what's your number?
My office number.
Should we call it? You want to give out that number? That's fine.
Yes, they could just call university for the fertility service.
Okay, got that, Peter? The University of Washington Fertility Service. Thanks a lot for your phone call.
Thanks for that pointer. Okay, bye.
All right, let's go to Vicki. She's listening to us today in the Central District. Vicki, thanks for being part of the conversation. What's your question?
I actually don't have a question. I have a daughter, 25-year-old daughter, that was born through the in vitro process at the University of Washington when Dr. Zaretsky was there. And I just wanted to say thank you, that every day I appreciate the miracle of her birth.
And how old's your daughter now?
She's 25. She's doing great.
Wow.
Well, congratulations. And as you know, I left the area for 20-some years, so it is like being the Brett Favre of reproductive medicine, you know. So this makes me feel really good to hear someone from my past. Thank you very much.
Vicki,
you're welcome.
Thanks for
was number 31.
Oh, yes, I remember.
Oh, yes, number 31. Let's go to Ellie. She's listening to us today in Wallingford. Ellie, good afternoon.
Hi. I'd like to hear you address the issue, environmental factors such as PCBs and phthalates in the environment. I understand that they've been highly implicated in reduced sperm counts in men.
Yes. Toxicology is a very exciting area because the sperm actually are a great way to study this because the numbers are so large in the cells that you make. And so we're looking at this now, and environmental additives and agents that are being put in plastics are really critical in that they do interfere with cell division. And so those areas are growing very, very rapidly. For women, we worry about hydrocarbon exposures and things like dry chemicals used for dry cleaning, for instance, anesthetic agents at high exposure. So the EPA and environmental groups have done really good in protecting employees and jobs from such toxins.
Does that answer your question, Ellie?
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. And we'll go to Jessica for our final question of the afternoon. She's calling us today from Renton. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
So this summer, when I was 6.5 months pregnant, my husband was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And we have recently, you can hear the baby in the background, we have recently just finished chemo and we're pretty sure that we're done with it. But one of the possible side effects of the chemo treatment might have been that he could become infertile. How often do you see that in your patients coming in, you know, say post-chemotherapy?
That's really one of the more exciting new development areas as well, not only for men but for women, for us to address preserving sperm beforehand. It is an important issue. It's related to the particular agents. Dr. Tom Walsh at the University of Washington is an expert in this area, and I'd advise you to give him a buzz as to the particular kind of agents your husband might have had in the process.
One final question. We're just about out of time, but what are the things on the horizon that you see for dealing with infertility that perhaps have shown some promise in early tests but are not yet verified?
Two new things. One is the freezing of eggs, the ability to save the human egg, a huge advance for women for fertility preservation, be they cancer patients, patients with chronic diseases such as irritable bowel on medications. The second is the genetics piece, being able to take a bunch of cells out of an early embryo, rapidly analyze it and tell the couple this embryo may look good, but it's genetically not for the following reasons.
And what are the things that you don't know that really puzzle you at this point in time in this research?
That first patient's question was really the answer is, you know, there is this whole issue of what makes a sperm and egg join we don't know, and secondly, what makes a normal embryo.
Dr. Paul Zaretsky, thank you so much for coming by again. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Paul Zaretsky, Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Washington from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.